Don't talk to strangers. Welcome back to this mini-season of Don't Talk to Strangers. This week, we talk about the murders, the investigation, and the trial. But before we dig in, I've received several messages about Leslie Allen Williams. We talked about him briefly in episode one, and yes, he does deserve more coverage. He was a violent and terrifying serial killer. I will be covering him in an upcoming episode of the Already Gone podcast, so keep an eye out for that in early spring. When we left off, Jennifer Wicks and Casey Fialek, both 12 years old and just weeks from starting seventh grade, the girls were farewelled in emotional, well-attended funerals, with hundreds mourning the young lives cut tragically short. For this episode, we must rewind back to the night the girls disappeared, before anyone knew they were missing, before two families were living their worst nightmare. And if you haven't listened to episode one, please go back and do so before you continue. On August 8, 1995, Casey and Jennifer are having a sleepover at Casey's house. This was not unusual, as the girls were friends and Jennifer often stayed the night. This night, however, was different. The girls locked themselves in a bedroom as if they were settled in for the evening, and, without anyone noticing, they snuck out the bedroom window and disappeared into the night. I'm sure they had what they thought was a foolproof plan. Sneak out, meet an older guy to buy beer, and then sneak back in later with the beer, and the parents will never know. To understand why the girls decided to sneak out of the house, cast your mind back. Back to when you were a preteen or a teen, do you remember looking at older kids who were drinking, going to parties, dating, and just wallowing in the unfairness of you not being old enough to join in those activities? Your parents probably told you no a lot, and some of you rebelled. It's what adolescents do. Rebellion isn't a rare occurrence, pushing boundaries. Some of you may now be parents and are well aware of this because you're experiencing it from the other side. You want your kids to behave and follow the rules, and your kids, well, they want to push boundaries. So the story is that the two girls were sneaking out because Casey knew a man, someone who had worked on her parents' house at some point. She and this man had stayed in touch, friendly. The way you do in a small town. Maybe she saw him at the park or at the store. Maybe she felt like she knew him because he'd been to her house. And maybe she assumed he was a safe person to be around. This man, he was old enough to get alcohol, and Casey was interested in trying beer. The man said he would buy beer for her on the night of the 8th, so she agreed to meet him. Casey's friend Jennifer accompanied her to this meeting, which took place in Central Park, a 25-minute walk from Casey's house. Casey took her backpack with her, indicating that she intended to bring the beer back to the house, maybe hide it in her room until her birthday, which was coming up in a couple of weeks. Or maybe the two girls planned to drink the beer that night. Around midnight, the girls met the man, as planned, and he brought a friend along. But he didn't hand over the beer for Casey to put in her backpack. Instead, the four of them went deeper into the park, into a secluded wooded area where they drank beer and hung out. But who are these two men? Aaron Stinchcomb was born October 2, 1974. He had a criminal record, and he'd already been sentenced to 28 years in prison for breaking and entering. As he was only 17 years old when sentenced, he first served time at a boot camp instead of an adult prison. At 19, he was transferred to the adult prison where he served a couple of months before his release. Despite receiving a lengthy prison sentence, Stinchcomb only served 18 months, which was the minimum of his 28-year term, before he was paroled in November of 1994. After his release, Aaron floated from place to place, crashing on couches, sleeping in parks, and staying with family members who were willing to give him a chance. When it came to giving him chances, Aaron's mother was done. A 1992 court record states that 17-year-old Aaron was no longer welcome at his mother's home. That bridge was burned. Aaron's grandparents, Santa and Floyd Stinchcomb, they agreed to let him stay for a few weeks, to give him time to get back on his feet. However, he was soon asked to leave after failing to follow household rules. There was to be no drinking in the Stinchcomb household, a rule put in place following a drunk driving incident that left Aaron's 35-year-old uncle with brain damage. But Aaron drank anyway, like the rules didn't apply to him, so he was asked to leave. And it's interesting to note that Aaron was not a blood relative of Santa and Floyd. And listeners, isn't that the sweetest name for an older couple? Santa and Floyd. Anyway, Aaron's mother married their son Dale and gave Aaron the Stinchcomb last name. It was assumed that Dale had adopted Aaron, but it was later discovered that nothing formal was ever put in place. But Dale raised Aaron like his own. Regardless, Santa and Floyd treated Aaron the same as their other grandchildren. After being asked to leave his grandparents' home because he wouldn't follow the rules, Aaron moved on to a cousin's house where he stayed with her and her two young children in February of 1995. But he wasn't there for more than a couple of weeks. After he moved out of his cousin's place, his residence is unknown, and it's reported that he was homeless, sleeping in parks or wherever he could find that was safe and warm. At the time of the murders, Aaron was a 20-year-old man. He was 6 feet tall with shaggy blonde hair and blue eyes. Aaron worked as a cook at the local Big Boy restaurant. He also did odd jobs here and there. This is how he met Casey. Aaron helped with painting work at the Fialak home over the summer, and the two kept in contact once the job was complete. And listeners, when I say keeping in contact, I doubt they exchanged phone numbers, but it's possible that she saw him around town and might have considered him someone that she knew. In 1995, Russell Escher was 30 years old. His parents, Bob and Betty, they adopted Russell when he was an infant as his mentally ill mother was unable to care for him. Bob and Betty took in many children that were in need, and the pair took in kids until they were well into their golden years. A selfless act of kindness that demonstrates the level of compassion this couple had. Bob and Betty reported that Russell's childhood was fairly normal, but they noticed that their dark-haired son was small for his age, that he was a slow learner, and he had trouble keeping up at school. By grade 6, his academic struggles were pronounced enough to warrant testing, and it was discovered that Russell had an IQ of about 60, which is the IQ you would expect to see in a third grader. He was tested again as an adult, and his IQ score was 74. The average IQ of an adult is between 90 and 110 points. A score of 74 put Russell well below normal range. Wanting the best for their son, Bob and Betty moved Russell to West Highland Christian Academy, a private school in Milford that could provide him more specialized and individual attention. For reasons unknown, Russell transferred back to the public high school. It's possible that while the smaller class sizes were helpful, the cost of tuition and transportation to the Christian Academy was not a sustainable option for his family. Something else about Russell, rather than maturing as he aged, Russell's behavior took a turn for the worse in high school. He fell in with a bad crowd, as they say, and started to copy the behaviors he saw around him. Russell had a history of adjusting his behavior to match whoever he was with. If he was with rowdy people, he became rowdy. If he was with people who loved sports, he too was a sports fan. This adaptive behavior may have been his coping mechanism, something he could do to hide the fact that he had differences from his peers. In addition to learning disabilities, Russell was a short man standing only 5 feet tall, and that was something he could not hide. But he could hide his intellectual differences by blending in with the crowd. Russell's parents believe that low self-esteem played a large role in his life choices. Russell was in and out of high school after being suspended in the 10th grade. He went back briefly to attend 11th grade before dropping out, and then returned and tried again for grade 12. Unsurprisingly, Russell did not graduate from high school. With his behavior worsening, Russell left home at age 16 and worked odd jobs between his arrests and issues with substance abuse. His drugs of choice were marijuana and speed. Russell did have a period of stability in his early 20s, where he got married and fathered a child, but the relationship and the consistency it provided did not last. In the 1980s, Russell added crack cocaine to the list of drugs he enjoyed, the addiction costing him his marriage and limiting access to his child. Soon he turned to the kindness of church programs to help him get back on his feet, but his drug and alcohol addiction resulted in him being asked to leave. In August of 1995, Russell was homeless and living behind the South Hill Apartments, less than a mile south of Milford Central Park. In addition to drug use, Russell's behavior scared his parents. And while I can't find any specifics as to what he did, I can tell you the steps they took to feel safe from Russell, to feel safe from their own son in their own home. Remember, Russell was a very short man, only 5 feet tall, not the kind of person you would describe as imposing. However, despite his small stature, his parents found him frightening. They had security measures outside their home to keep them safe, such as a wrought iron front door to keep intruders, or in this case, to keep their son out. Bob, his father, slept with a gun under his pillow, and during Russell's brief visits to the home, Betty hid her purse because she was afraid that her son would steal from her while he was visiting. Things got so bad that Bob barred Russell from the house. He told Betty, "Just don't let him in anymore." While we don't have details describing exactly what Russell did to scare his family, we can assume it was unsettling and extreme for them to sleep with a gun under the pillow and bar him from the house. In addition to his bizarre behavior and his drug use, Russell had a history of supplying alcohol to minors. In July of 1990, he was at a party with 15-year-old Jason Tunstall, who was enjoying the summer between his freshman and sophomore years at Milford High School. Russell and another man provided Jason with alcohol, and Jason became so intoxicated that he literally passed out on the train tracks at the edge of town. Jason was killed when a train coming through struck his unconscious body. While his parents grieved the senseless death of their son, a local man put up a $1,000 cash reward for information leading to the name of the person or persons who supplied alcohol to Jason that night. By August, Russell's name was put forward. He and another adult man were charged with providing alcohol to underage people, a misdemeanor. However, since his actions resulted in a death, Russell received jail time and spent 45 days behind bars. But the death of Jason and time in jail did not deter Russell, and he continued to buy alcohol for minors. Teens in town knew that if they had money, they could go to Russell, and for a small fee, they'd be supplied with beer. Aaron and Russell were only recently acquainted. Russell was 10 years older than Aaron, so it's not like they grew up together. According to various newspaper reports, they had only been seen together in the week leading up to Casey and Jennifer's disappearance. Not long, but long enough to plan and commit a truly shocking crime. Casey and Jennifer arrive at the park late in the evening, and they find Russell and Aaron. The girls had no idea the dark turn their night would take. Instead of paying for alcohol and returning home as planned, the two men assaulted the girls, both physically and sexually, before stabbing them. Aaron stabbed Casey in the chest, and Russell strangled Jennifer before stabbing her. And listeners, that's all the detail that I'm going to go into here. The specific details of the assault leading to their deaths adds nothing to this story. Suffice to say, these men had no respect for the value of human life. When the attack was over and the girls were dead, Russell and Aaron went to work concealing their crime. They hid the small bodies of the two children they murdered in a nearby culvert. They hid the girls' garments and belongings in a bag that they later threw into Moore Lake. They stashed the murder weapon, which was a knife, and burned their own clothes. The pair likely thought that they removed all the evidence that could trace the crime back to them. And while DNA testing was definitely a thing in 1995, it's unlikely that Aaron and Russell thought about it the way we would think about DNA testing today. And in the end, DNA testing would not be needed, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. At the end of the night, Jennifer and Casey did not make it home. They didn't climb in through the bedroom window after a risky adventure. What started out as sneaky fun turned into a nightmare from which there was no return. Jennifer and Casey are reported missing to police on the afternoon of August 9th, and as part of their investigation, police questioned anyone they thought could have information. And by 11:45 p.m. on the 9th, police have a tip, their first real lead. According to the tip, two teenage girls were planning to meet Aaron Stinchcomb, a cook from the local Big Boy restaurant. This tip was called in by Aaron's coworker, who thought the timing of comments made by Aaron and the disappearance of the girls was too close for comfort. A friend of Casey and Jennifer also talked to police, saying that the girls planned on sneaking out to meet some men to drink beer in the park. From these two unconnected pieces of information, the Fialek family and police began tracking down Aaron to bring him in for questioning. Sean Casero, a childhood friend of Aaron's, was also connected to the Fialek family, and he was helping them look for her when he found out that Aaron was a suspect. Sean knew a few places that Aaron could be, and he, along with Casey's sister and another teenager, began looking for him. They found Aaron at Moore Dam, a place he was known to hang out and sometimes camp if he couldn't find a couch to crash on. Aaron was not the only person they found at Moore Dam. Russell was there with him. Sean was not initially suspicious of Aaron, thinking that there must be a misunderstanding, and maybe they could go to the police station and clear his name. But as Sean continued to ask questions and talk to Aaron, he started to wonder if his friend could be involved. So Aaron, Russell, Sean, and Casey's sister and the teenage boy, they all get into Sean's car headed for the Milford Police Department to make a statement. And by all accounts, Aaron and Russell willingly got into the car to go with them. As they're driving to the police station, a patrol car pulls over Sean's vehicle. The officer wants to speak with Aaron and Russell, and seeing them together, this group, police become suspicious of Sean, and they start wondering if he could have a connection to the disappearance of the two girls. Sean explains that no, he's just a concerned citizen, he's trying to help. Police tell him that going forward, he should stay away from Aaron and Russell. So, in what can best be described as a miscalculation on the part of Milford police, they did not take Aaron and Russell to the station. Instead, they questioned them there on the side of the road. And when Aaron is questioned, he gets angry. This change in demeanor, this angry switch, this is something Aaron is known for. His coworkers at the local restaurant, they said that he was the type of guy that could go from normal behavior to yelling and throwing things in the blink of an eye. So police talk to him, and Aaron denies any knowledge and any involvement in the disappearance of the girls. However, he does admit to seeing the girls Tuesday morning, 12 hours before they were last seen at home. Aaron says that Casey approached him while he was sitting in the park. Aaron said that Casey asked if he would buy beer for her and a friend for their sleepover that night. And Aaron tells police that no, man, he declined her request. He says that he only buys beer for his family and friends, and then only if they're drinking at his house, which is a really interesting comment from a homeless man, but Okay. So during this informal questioning, Aaron maintains that this is the last time he saw Casey, and since they don't have anything concrete, they release Aaron and Russell without ever taking them into a police station. And we need to let that sink in for a minute. Police interviewed Aaron and Russell within hours of the girls going missing and let them go. It's very frustrating, but the good news is this does not change the outcome of our story. At this time, there is no mention of any police interest in Russell, and it's unclear if police even thought he could be involved in the girls' disappearance. Police were much more interested in Aaron, and they kept tabs on him as they continued looking for the girls. But once the bodies of Jennifer and Casey are discovered in the culvert in Central Park, police go back to their conversation with Aaron and decide to bring him in for questioning. They want to speak with him again. Police get a tip that Aaron and Russell, along with a third man who is not believed to be involved in the murders, are at Aaron's grandparents' home. And on Sunday afternoon, 24 hours after the remains of the girls were found, officers are dispatched to the house where they intercept the men as they're leaving the home, about to depart in a car. At this point, they do take Aaron and Russell back to the police station and separate them. Each man is in his own interrogation room to be interviewed by a detective. And during the interviews, each man gave their own version of what happened. Their statements are really similar. The order of the events was the same, but they differ in one key aspect. Who is at fault? You won't be surprised to learn that each man pointed the finger at the other. In Russell's statement, he said the murders were discussed and planned on Tuesday the 8th, prior to meeting the girls in the park. From his confession, it sounds as if the murders were Aaron's idea and that Russell was just following instructions. Russell told police that Aaron told him to kill Jennifer so she would not see Aaron killing Casey. Now, when Aaron shares his version of events, he admits that he did, in fact, meet Casey that night and supply her with beer, contrary to what he told police when they interviewed him by the car the day before. In Aaron's story, Russell accompanied him to the park with multiple bottles of alcohol, and this is where their confessions differ. In Aaron's confession, the four were drinking together when Russell told Aaron he wanted to have sex with the girls. Aaron says that he did not intervene. He didn't encourage Russell's assault, but he didn't stop it either. When the girls fought off Russell's advances, Russell became angry and beat Casey while Aaron held Jennifer, and then Russell beat Jennifer and killed her. Russell then commanded that Aaron attack Casey and, quote, finish her off. Aaron said that he thought Casey was already dead, so he did what Russell asked him to. Russell's confession paints Aaron as the aggressor, as if Russell acted as he did only because he was afraid of Aaron. Aaron's confession paints Russell as the aggressor. The confessions of both men are recorded as well as written out and signed. To say that Russell cooperated with authorities is an understatement. He not only told the police what happened on the night the girls were killed, he accompanied them in handcuffs to the park to walk them through events. He showed them where they could find the knife used in the attack. The 6-inch folding knife was found hidden in the siding of a business on Main Street. Then, Russell led police to the location where the ripped and ruined clothing of the girls was burned. Then he led them to the location where they could find Casey's backpack. Police now had a full confession and the murder weapon. This was more than enough for the prosecutor to bring both men up on charges. When particularly brutal crimes are committed, the question on everyone's lips is why? Why did this happen? Why did they hurt these children? This case, these brutal and senseless murders, are no exception. Multiple motives were floated in court and talked about around the township. With the criminal history of the men and Casey's mother having a connection to law enforcement through her job as dispatcher, some theorized that Casey was lured to the park and murdered as an act of revenge against the police, meaning that Jennifer was somehow guilty by association, or more likely, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Another theory is that the men weren't happy living on the streets, and they decided they'd rather be in prison with a warm bed and 3 meals a day. Going back to prison requires a crime, and the two girls were their ticket to jail time. And listeners, there is no explanation for something like this. There is no answer here, just a reminder to be vigilant, to watch out not only for your own children, but be aware of the children of others. This story is a grim reminder that no place, not even the charming corners of Milford and its picturesque park, are safe from the worst types of violence. Aaron and Russell are arraigned on Tuesday, the 15th of August, 1995. Both men are charged with murder. Neither man enters a plea. The court photos show the accused standing together, stocky Aaron with his long blonde hair towering over the much shorter Russell. At the arraignment, Oakland County Assistant Prosecutor Lisa Tomko presented the revenge theory as the motive for the crime, saying, quote, "My understanding is the defendants wanted to get back at the Milford Police Department, and Casey Fialek was the daughter of a police dispatcher." After hearing overwhelming circumstantial evidence coupled with their confessions, the judge held both men without bond in the Oakland County Jail to await their trial. Aaron Stinchcomb and Russell Escher, the men charged with the murders of Casey and Jennifer, would be tried separately for the crimes, with Aaron's trial being held first. Now, prosecutors asked that the men be tried together, meaning one trial with two separate juries, but this request was denied. There would be two trials, each man facing charges on his own. Both trials would be overseen by Judge Hilda Gage. And both men will face four charges: two first-degree premeditated murder charges and two first-degree felony murder charges. For the court to find either man guilty of first-degree murder, they must prove that the murder was premeditated and deliberate. To be found guilty of a first-degree felony murder charge, the court must prove that the men committed the murder while committing or attempting to commit a felony. In this case, the felony was first-degree criminal sexual misconduct. Or that the men participated in a crime where there was knowledge of the intent to kill. These men supplied alcohol to children, children that they sexually assaulted and murdered. Both men made full confessions, and so their trials are not expected to take a long time. On Monday, the 12th of February, 1996, barely 6 months after the murders, Aaron Stinchcomb was led into the courtroom. His long blonde hair is cut short, and he is wearing civilian clothes in place of the orange prison uniform that he wore at his arraignment in August. He looked tidy, a stark contrast to his disheveled and unkempt appearance at the arraignment. And I'm certain that his attorney wanted him to make a good impression for the jury. But listeners, no matter how presentable he appeared, it was not enough to overcome the brutal actions he chose in Central Park or the violence he leveled against two children. Donna Prendergast, prosecutor for the state, she retold the events of August 8th and 9th in grim detail, far more detail than is included in this podcast. And while I'm here to retell this terrible story and not let these much-loved young girls be forgotten, I won't be going into the details of their deaths. It is the prosecutor's job to paint a clear picture of what happened to Casey and Jennifer at the hands of these men. Suffice to say that she did her job very well. The prosecutor's recounting of the events brought the darkest and most awful details of the murders into the light of day so the jury heard the full scope of the crimes. She referred to Aaron and Russell as monsters, and she told the jury how they lured two 12-year-old girls, two children, into a dark and secluded area of Central Park for the express purpose of raping and murdering them. Presented at trial were the confessions and testimony of those who knew of Casey and Aaron's plans to meet up so she could buy beer from him. Physical evidence was presented in the form of fibers from the girls' clothing on Aaron's clothing. However, this evidence played a minor role in comparison to other items submitted during the trial. In his defense, Aaron said he was coerced into making a false confession, and what he admitted on tape and in writing was not accurate. Despite his claims, the judge ruled that his confession was admissible, and it was heard by the jury. Aaron's lawyer argued that while Aaron was present while the murders were committed, he did not plan them and only went along with the crime because he was afraid of Russell. Burly, 6-foot-tall Aaron claimed that he did the most terrible things imaginable to children because he was afraid of Russell, an unarmed man who stood 5 feet tall. And if it sounds like I'm not convinced, it's because I'm not. And neither was the jury. After a week of testimony, the loved ones of Casey and Jennifer, along with many concerned Milford locals, waited for the verdict. And when the jury came back, before spectators could enter the courtroom, there were metal detectors and searches. This was such an emotionally charged case, and the authorities are not taking any chances. They didn't want someone to smuggle in a weapon and create chaos. And in addition to worrying about what a spectator could do, there are also reports that Aaron made threatening remarks aimed at a prosecutor. Fortunately, the proceedings were uneventful, and after 6 hours of deliberations, the jury is ready with a verdict. Aaron showed no emotion as the guilty verdict was read, the jury finding him guilty on 1 count of first-degree murder, 1 count of felony murder, and 2 counts of second-degree murder. Casey and Jennifer's families wept as the verdict was read. One killer brought to justice, and he would never see the outside world again. Aaron was led away, back to jail, where he would spend his days until his sentencing hearing. Russell's trial was held about a week later, beginning February 26th. There was a delay between the two trials, which was needed because they wanted to do psychological testing to make sure Russell was fit to stand trial. Donna Prendergast, the prosecutor from Aaron's trial, also served as a prosecutor on Russell's case. Again, she recounted the events and the crimes committed by the men. The jury in this case had a different challenge. Russell's lawyer did not argue his innocence. In fact, he fully admits that Russell participated in the murder. But he posed another question. Did Russell have the mental capacity to be fully punished for his crimes? With an IQ of 74, Russell could be considered mentally impaired. So his lawyer argued that Russell could not be charged with premeditated murder if he didn't have the capacity to adequately plan and execute the crimes. In this version of events, Russell was complicit in Aaron's plans. He did what he was accused of doing, but he should not be found guilty of murder in the first degree since he had very little ability to plan and lead. Russell's lawyer said, quote, "If he did not have the state of mind to commit first-degree murder, then he should not be convicted of first-degree murder." His lawyer brought up Russell's habit of following along with others, even if the plans were troublesome, something he'd been doing since he was a teenager. We talked about this earlier in the episode, how Russell changed his behavior so he could fit in with a variety of people, and that he uses this behavior as a coping mechanism. During the trial, even though he'd told the same story to police on different occasions, Russell changed his story. He said he passed out several times the night of the murders and doesn't remember committing the crimes he's charged with. He said that Aaron woke him up after the murders were committed and told him that he needed help hiding the bodies and getting rid of evidence. However, in this retelling, Russell said he didn't remember burning the clothes or hiding the backpack. When challenged by the prosecutor with evidence of his confession and intimate knowledge of the crime, Russell said Aaron told him about it, and he was basing his confession on what Aaron said happened. Russell said that his original confession should be suppressed and that this new version of events should be presented, which the court denied. On the 5th of March, the jury deliberated for only an hour before returning with a guilty verdict. Days after Russell was found guilty, Aaron was sentenced. And before we talk about sentencing, I want to bring up that Michigan was the first English-speaking territory in the world to ban the death penalty. So no matter how terrible these crimes were, the death penalty was never an option in this case. The strongest sentence the men could receive is life in prison. Aaron was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for both first-degree murder charges. Due to double jeopardy laws, he could not be sentenced for the second-degree charges. Aaron Stinchcomb will never be released from prison. Casey's mom took the opportunity to speak at the sentencing, saying, quote, "Every time you feel afraid because the other guy is bigger, I want you to remember Casey and Jennifer." And, quote, "You have proved that you are a coward and a little boy who hasn't done a damn thing right in his life." In response, Aaron said nothing. His face was emotionless and cold. Jennifer's father chose to write his impact statement down in a letter, hoping that one day the gravity of what Aaron did would sink in. The judge handed down his life sentence, and Aaron is let out of the courtroom. Russell is also sentenced to life in prison without chance of parole. Unlike Aaron, Russell chose to make a statement to the court and used this time to again claim his innocence. During the trial testimony, Deborah Wicks became increasingly angry at the series of events that led to her daughter's murder. Aaron and Russell were directly responsible, but Deborah believed that there were two other guilty parties. She filed a lawsuit against the city of Milford and Renee Lang, Casey's mom, in the amount of $10,000. In the suit, Deborah outlines Renee Lang's negligence, leaving two preteen girls at home without adult supervision, failing to check in on the girls in the evening when she returned home. During the trial, it was revealed that the night the girls were murdered was not the first time they had snuck out of the house, a detail that Deborah was not aware of until she heard about it during the trial. Deborah argues that had she known the girls had been sneaking out, she would have put a stop to the sleepovers. Deborah's lawyer explained in an interview that the suit against Renee was intended to be covered by her homeowner's policy, and as soon as the insurance company settled, there would be no further action against Casey's family. The case against the city of Milford concerns their lack of action in removing Aaron and Russell from the park, a location they were known to frequent and sleep. Deborah's lawyer went on to say that he knew the case against the city would be long fought, and they were willing to follow it through to the appeals court if need be. If Milford reached a settlement with the family, the terms of this settlement was not made public. And listeners, it should come as no surprise that both Aaron and Russell's lawyers appealed their sentences, as they have a legal right to do. Aaron's lawyer brought up multiple issues that he wanted to appeal. Aaron believed that his Miranda rights were violated since he wasn't read them before his confession. The appeals court ruled that since he gave his confession before he was in custody, and he confessed voluntarily, he did not need to have the rights read prior to the confession to make it admissible. After his rights were read, Aaron was not given a lawyer. However, he didn't ask for one. He also argued that the fiber evidence used in the trial was obtained without a warrant and should not have been used at trial. The appeals court reviewed the claim and decided that, even without the fiber evidence, the verdict would have been the same. Aaron next claimed that he was denied a fair trial due to prosecutorial misconduct. The prosecutor described these crimes using words like horrifying and evil, which the appeals court decided were accurate and in no way inappropriate for the prosecutor to use. I mean, how else do you describe the rape and murder of a child? Horrifying and evil are spot on. Finally, the appeals court denied his claim of ineffective counsel, as Aaron was unable to prove that his lawyer's performance was less than what was reasonably expected. There was one aspect of the appeal that the court did agree on. At Aaron's trial, he was found guilty on four counts, one of first-degree murder, one of felony murder, and two of second-degree murder. Four murder counts, two victims. Something doesn't add up. And this is why he was only sentenced for the two first-degree murder counts, as double jeopardy laws prevent someone from being charged twice for the same murder. The court agreed that this was not correct, and the second-degree murder charges were vacated. However, this ruling did not change the sentencing, as the first-degree murder charges were upheld. He will live out his life in a Michigan correctional facility. Russell's appeal read very much the same as Aaron's. He claimed his Miranda rights weren't read, but this was because they didn't need to be. Ineffective counsel was another claim which couldn't be proven because his lawyer made decisions in line with the evidence. The major difference between the two appeal documents is that Russell contends there was not enough evidence to convict him of first-degree murder. Well, the appeals court disagreed. In his own confession, which he did recant and change, Russell admitted to killing Jennifer. He admitted to pausing and hesitating before killing her. That's a confession to the murder and to premeditation. Premeditation does not need to mean the murder was fully planned, just that the killer had time to think about their actions. The pause where he hesitated, that is premeditation, so the rulings were upheld. At the time of this recording, Aaron Stinchcomb is being held at the Alger Correctional Facility in Munising, Michigan. Russell Escher is serving his term at the Gus Harrison Correctional Facility in Adrian, Michigan. Their life sentences with no chance of parole means that unless they have a successful appeal, they will live out the rest of their lives behind bars. If Casey and Jennifer were alive today, they would be in their late 30s. I wonder what their lives would have been like. Would they have moved away from Milford, explored the world, or would they still be happily living in the village they called home? This concludes Season 2 of Don't Talk to Strangers. We will return in the spring of 2020 with a new season and a new case. Much of the research for this season came from court documents, as well as the Detroit News, Detroit Free Press, and Hometown Life newspapers. Season 2 of Don't Talk to Strangers was written by Jess Watford, edited by Nina Instead, production support provided by Cesare Gray and Lisa Strawn. Don't Talk to Strangers is created by Nina Instead and Spective Productions. I'm Nina Instead. I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.